Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't you know we're gonna have,
yeah, we did.
Solartopia.
We started to burn many things we found. This is Harvey Wasserman back for another hour at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. We have a great, great show with you today for a great, great guest. I'm calling you from Los Angeles, and Paul Geip, my guest, is in Bakersfield, California, not so far away. Paul, are you there? Paul, can I hear you here?
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now, loud and clear. So we're good for, we're going to go till 2:30 or so Pacific time, 5:30 Eastern. We'll take a short break, and we're going to get back with you, and we're going to devote the whole hour to the great Paul Geip, one of the true pioneers of renewable energy. When I mean say pioneer, I mean way, way, way back. Paul, when did you start with wind energy?
Let's see, probably 76.
And what were you doing before then, running a nuclear plant?
No, actually, I was fighting coal-fired power plants.
Oh, where were you living?
I was, at the time, I was working on regulating the surface mining of coal, strip mining of coal, and that's how I got into renewable energy in the campaign to regulate the surface mining of coal. In other words, if you dig the coal out of the ground, you had to put the ground back the way you found it. And in those days, they didn't have to do that. They'd just leave a big hole in the ground and walk away. And so I worked as a college student on a campaign to regulate strip mining of coal, and that's what led me to renewable energy, to alternative energy in the mid-70s.
Where were you as a college student when you were working on this?
And I was in the state of Indiana, but I worked not only in the state of Indiana, but on the Federal Surface Mining Act. In fact, when Jimmy Carter signed the surface mining bill, gosh, I don't know, I guess it was 76, or 77, I was invited to the White House bill signing ceremony. It's the only time any president has ever invited me to the Rose Garden. Unfortunately, at the time I was in Montana taking down used wind turbines.
What?
I couldn't make Jimmy's invitation.
How did that work out? What do you mean you were taking down used wind turbines? Were they from the New Deal from the 1930s?
Yeah, exactly. That's how I got started in the wind industry, was taking down used wind chargers, wind turbines that were installed in the 1920s, 1930s, up into the 1950s until the REA, the Rural Electrification Administration, extended electricity to the far reaches of the U.S., and these wind turbines became redundant. And so they were out there, and at the time, they were the most reliable wind turbines available anywhere in the world. And so we, that was a number of us crazy pioneers in this business, scoured the Great Plains of Canada and the United States looking for these things. And while I was out there hanging on the top of a windmill, Jimmy Carter's invitation to the Rose Garden was sitting in my mailbox back in Pennsylvania.
Well, you should have sent him a note with a picture of you climbing a wind tower and invited him to come out and help you. What happened to those old wind chargers? They were great machines.
Well, they were, and of course that's why we tracked them down. They were far more reliable than the very crude machines that were being built in the mid-1970s. They were, in fact, more reliable than the stuff that was being built at the time. And so, and in fact, in my books on wind energy and in my upcoming book on wind energy, I point out that this is one of the things that kind of misdirected the development of wind energy in the United States is because we had those early machines. When we began to relook or to renew our interest in wind energy, those were the ones we gravitated towards. And so that kind of captured our thinking, whereas the Danes at the same time didn't have that. They had a different history to look back to, and that history was far bigger machines that were connected to the grid. The machines I was looking for in the mid-1970s were battery-charging wind turbines at very remote homesteads. Sometimes they didn't even have roads to these homesteads, big piles of glass batteries, whereas the Danes could look back in the history of using wind energy in their country, far different way of using wind energy. They used it in community groups, small power stations that would feed a community rather than an individual home. And these wind turbines, even in the 1920s, were connected to the electricity network. So when the Danes began looking at wind energy, they came from a completely different perspective. And that, of course, has proven to be a successful perspective. And for many of us in Wind Energy United States, we kind of got misdirected, misrouted by trying to track down these old machines, and it kind of colored our thinking of what wind energy could be.
Well, what happened to the old machines? Were they reused?
They're still out there. You can still find them. There are still people who use them. They're out there. Some of those machines, the Jacobs machines, were, you know, very rugged. Some of them that I found had been running into the 1950s, so only 20 years before I came along. And they were still usable. You didn't really even have to rebuild them, you know, paint the blades and stuff. Oh, you can give them a fancy coat of paint. And so they're still out there, but, you know, the wind industry has gone far beyond that now. I mean, you wouldn't want them today. You could buy a Berge, would be a far better machine.
So some of these machines are actually pushing 90 years old and are still out there generating electricity?
Yeah, sure.
That's fantastic.
I mean, I couldn't name one off the top of my head at the moment, but I know they're out there.
Amazing. Now, Paul Geip, that's G-I-P-E, you live in Bakersfield, California, although you spent many years up in Toronto working with the government up there to promote wind energy and renewables. But you, as a pioneer in the wind business, really got in on the ground floor. What we're going to do, we're going to take this and we're going to talk about the situation today, and especially the situation in Germany and the use of the feed-in tariffs. But what lessons did you bring forward from the early, you know, pioneer? I remember seeing a picture of you, I'm pretty sure, with a serious head of very long hair and a beard. Was that actually you, or was that your evil twin?
Yeah, that was my alter ego. My wife hates that photograph. She said she would never marry somebody who looked like that. But no, that's me. I got my Select Dyers cap on and a cigar in my hand, and I'm sitting on a pile of used wind turbines that I had just reclaimed.
And what did you do with the used wind turbines?
I sold them. I was one of the major... I made my money as a junk windmill salesman. I got in the junk windmill business. I was one of the principal, you know, wholesalers of junk windmills, used windmills, and I would sell them to remanufacturers like Northern Power System up in Vermont. And they would take them and they would clean them up, rewind the generators, put new blades on them, and they would sell them as remanufactured units with a warranty and so on.
How long did you do this?
I only did it for a couple of years because, it's a limited supply of machines, you know. There's only so much out there.
So do you think the country has been effectively scoured for all the old windmills? Are there no more out there to be had?
Well, I like to say, yes, it has been effectively scoured, but you can still discover them. It can make a great adventure. I remember, I think, in the mid-90s, late 90s, we were driving along a road in Montana, and I thought I saw a Jacobs on a tower off in the distance. Now, I'm not interested anymore, so I didn't drive over there and look at it. So, yeah, they're out there, but are you going to drive just down any old dirt road in Wyoming and find one? No. I can tell you where you might find one, but you're not going to get your hands on it. That's in Grand Teton National Park I forget exactly the road that it's on, but there's a couple of turbines. There is a turbine there. It's an old Jacobs machine. Well, maybe it was a wind charger, but, you know, it's in my book. And Mormon Row, that's it. It's on Mormon Row in Grand Teton National Park. There's a wind charger.
All right, so all you people listening in who are driving around Grand Teton Park, go to Mormon Road and see if you can find this old wind turbine, and then buy it and send it to Paul. He'll recondition it and sell it to Pacific Gas.
I think it's part of the national park, so I don't think you're going to go. It's like a bear, you know. You can't just go out there and take the thing and walk off with it.
Yeah, right. All right. So, Paul Guy, tell us, you've written a bunch of books on wind power and on renewable energy. Give us the titles and tell us your website. We'll come back to that later in the show, but I want to hear it now.
Okay, well, my website's wind-works, W-O-R-K-S.org, wind-works.org. My books have gone by various titles. The shortest one is my little book on wind called Wind Energy Basics, and my big book is Wind Power, Renewable Energy for Home, Farm, and Business, and there'll be a new version of that coming out in late 2015.
So if you're doing a new version, then there must still be a market for people buying these books and doing wind power on their own.
Well, we're going to find out.
All right. But you sell your own books, or do you have a publisher?
No. This is by Chelsea Green. They're a major progressive publisher. They've published just recently Ugo Bardi's book from the Club of Rome. They did the Namala Meadows books, you know, The Limits to Growth. Jorgen Rahner's. They're a major progressive publisher in Vermont, and they're my publisher too.
Very good. All right. So, Paul Guy, let's take the most important piece of this first. You are a strong advocate and one of the few people who can really explain coherently the magic and the importance of something called feed-in tariffs. And I've had you on the show before to explain it, but we have, time has passed, and things are happening. And I want to say, and we should have a major celebration. Today is the first full day in God knows how many years when the Vermont Yankee nuclear plant is totally offline and will not reopen.
That is something to celebrate, Harvey, and I just noticed that before we got on the line together.
Right, and I have a piece about it, which I hope will be published at PRN, and which is going around the Internet, commemorating and celebrating yesterday's definitive and final shutdown of the Vermont Yankee nuclear reactor at Vernon, Vermont. People have been working on this for 40 years. I remember in 1973 and 74, when we first printed the first No Nukes bumper stickers. We also printed a bumper sticker that said, Dismantle the Nukes, Vermont Yankee and Yankee Row. Now, Yankee Row, which was on the western part of the Deerfield River, shut in the early 1990s. It was actually hit by lightning. And because it was such an old reactor, the Congress demanded that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission do a test for embrittlement. And the industry, the owners of Yankee Row, could not do the test. And as a result, they never reopened that reactor. The other one, Vermont Yankee, they made a deal. They were owned by a number of utilities. And then Entergy, this Mikinuk operator, this fleet operator of nuclear reactors based in New Orleans, they came in and they bought Vermont Yankee along with a bunch of other nukes. And when they bought Vermont Yankee, they made some very specific legal contracts with the state of Vermont on circumstances under which they would close Vermont Yankee.
They did indeed, didn't they, Harvey?
They did indeed, and then they broke every damn one of those agreements. And, you know, when it came time for the legitimate and obvious shutdown of the Vermont Yankee nuclear plant, as per their agreements with the state of Vermont, they just went into court. And, you know, it was kind of like how the white people treated the Indians.
No, they just walked away from the contract. They said, we said that, but that doesn't really apply to what we do here. We see the same kind of business transactions in the nuclear industry in Ontario. And of course, we've seen the same things with Diablo Canyon here in California. But the difference is that in Vermont, I think that's what you're leading up to, is that the legislature said, "Oh, wait a minute, you can't do that. We have an agreement with you, with the state of Vermont, with the people of Vermont, to shut this plant down. Shut it down."
That's right. And then Entergy said, they actually said, and not in so many words, but they actually said that they didn't really know what they were signing.
I guess you just can't get good attorneys these days.
Yeah. And you know, that marijuana in Vermont, it's so powerful, they must have been, I guess they just had memory loss or something. You know, you almost were waiting them to claim that the state of Vermont spiked their drinks when they were signing the contracts or something like that.
Well, while this is a good time to celebrate, I think it's also time to offer an invitation to you to come back to California after the Californians are successful in closing the two units at Diablo Canyon, which is looking ever more likely.
Well, let's talk about that. All right, so we'll talk about that first then. I am actually in California. I have two grandsons in Valley Village in Los Angeles, and we have bought a house which we're going to solarize, and I am turning 69 years old tomorrow, so I'm getting up towards my dotage here. So I plan on putting around in a little pool and going to see my grandsons every day. And, you know, in California, as you know, Paul, since you're a Californian, the ratepayers in the north, in the Bay Area, up from San Luis Obispo, pay for it. But the people in the south of Diablo Canyon, we get the radiation. And so, you know, my focus now very strongly is on shutting Diablo Canyon. Now, you have let slip this phrase that you think it's going to, apparently, if I understood you correctly, you think it's going to shut fairly soon. So tell me why.
Well, I don't think it's necessarily going to shut fairly soon, but I think that the handwriting is on the wall. Almost all indicators are that PG&E is desperate to keep the plant open. And when you see a utility the size of PG&E in desperation, it indicates that inside the company they know a lot that they're not letting out to the public, or it's being under confidentiality clauses released to the Public Utility Commission or the NRC, but because of confidentiality clauses, we're not getting access to that. PG&E seems to be quite fearful that they're not going to be able to keep the plant in operation, and that's a good sign. PG&E is on the ropes in terms of their public perception. They had the San Bruno natural gas disaster, killed a lot of people, and then to top that off, if that wasn't enough of an insult to the people of California that they couldn't manage their natural gas system, and remember, a nuclear power plant's far more complex and far more dangerous in a regional disaster than a gas pipeline explosion, that PG&E colluded with the chairman of the Public Utility Commission here in the state of California, his chief of staff, and other commissioners to try and cherry-pick the administrative law judges who would hear the case, because PG&E was fined, and they don't want to pay the fine that they were charged, and they're trying to renegotiate the fine. And they were basically caught with their emails down, colluding with the chairman of the Public Utility Commission, who, of course, as we all know and many of your listeners probably know, was a former senior vice president at Southern California Edison, a man who certainly should know nuclear power.
Yes, and Michael Peavy was his name, although, you know, to call this guy Peavy at the same time we're working for PV, photovoltaic cells, was a bit of a humorous contradiction. Now, Jerry Brown has named the next chair of the Public Utilities Commission, a guy named Michael Picker. Do you know much about Michael Picker?
I know.
Paul?
I'm still here. I'm still in a state of shock.
Oh.
That Jerry Brown would name Michael Picker as a chairman to replace Michael Peavy after the scandal of Peavy's collusion with the regulated utilities in the state, that he would name another person who is sympathetic to the utilities' point of view as a commissioner of the PUC. It recalls to mind, to me, that the Public Utility Commission is presumably a regulator to regulate electric utilities in the best interest of the people of California, not in the best interest of the regulated parties.
So Michael Picker has a similar history with Michael Peavy?
Well, they come from different backgrounds, but I think they might have similar worldviews.
Well, that's not encouraging. But Michael Peavy was forced out, essentially, by citizen pressure.
No, he hasn't been forced out, and this is what's so disturbing. He has said he will not ask for reappointment. He has not been fired. He has not been indicted. He has not resigned. Jerry Brown is letting Michael Peavy step out from his PUC commissioner role without taking direct action.
Well, all right, then. At least he's not. Of course, Peavy's old too. I mean, it would have been a stretch for him to serve another term. And you're right; there doesn't seem to be much justice in this. Michael Peavy has been an incredibly corrupt, pro-nuclear, pro-utility hack. I guess is the best.
Yeah, but it goes well beyond Peavy. It includes Florio. Florio was part of these. It's another commissioner at the PUC. Another Jerry Brown selected commissioner. And what makes what adds salt to the wounds is that Florio, for the progressive community, was thought to be a progressive's choice for the PUC because it came from the turn from a citizens action group, and he hasn't resigned. Turn hasn't asked for him to resign; he's still there. Brown hasn't fired him, so the corruption, or the appearance of corruption, goes much further than Peavy himself. It goes to the heart of the institution and what's the purpose of the institution. This is what former PUC Chairman Loretta Lynch said in her op-ed in the San Francisco Chronicle, is what was the purpose of the Public Utility Commission? What is its raison d'etre? What's the reason for the Public Utility Commission? And that has been subverted by, not just by Peavy, but by successive governors. Schwarzenegger, Brown, suggested successive legislatures, and by our willing, the citizens of California, acquiescence in letting this happen. There's just no outrage that the attitude that pervades the Public Utility Commission of the state of California is that's what's best for the electric utilities is best for the people of California. Not what is the best for the people of California. It's what is best for the utilities is therefore best for the people of California. Was it Alfred Sloan, or was it one of the other founders of GM?
It was a guy named Charles Wilson. He was in the Eisenhower administration.
Well, the one who said what's good for GM is good for the country.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Well, so, Paul Guy, what do we want now to have happen? You have advocated very effectively the use of a feed-in tariff to promote a transition to a solartopian, to a renewable-based economy. And so before our break, I want you to lay out very, very quickly, and then we'll come back in great detail and also go into great detail about what's happening in Europe with the feed-in tariff. But what exactly is a feed-in tariff, and what would it do for a state like California?
Well, very simply, Harvey, a feed-in tariff says if you pay for it, they will come. That is, if you set a price that you believe you can develop wind or solar for, and you offer that price to everyone, not just Pacific Gas and Electric, not just Southern California Edison, not just Electricity de France, but you, me, our neighbors, and the people down the street, anyone who is willing to take the financial risk to develop renewable energy, if they can do that, they will be paid this price. It's the way we used to regulate electric utilities in the United States before so-called restructuring, before this neoliberal ideology swept aside all concerns about our communities, about the public interest at regulatory authorities like the California Energy Commission, or, as another example of a scandal-plagued institution, Indiana Utility Regulatory Commission. And we can talk about that as well, Harvey, because it's not nuclear power in Indiana. It's coal gasification plants that remind me of nuclear power boondoggles of the 70s.
Well, how do you set the price? What you're saying, basically, a feed-in tariff, you put out a call and you offer a certain price for all electricity produced by wind and solar.
Correct. I mean, you have different... Okay, the key is that it's based on the cost of generation plus a reasonable profit. This is exactly how we used to regulate electric utilities in the United States. We'd say, if you build a power plant, it's going to cost so much to build it, cost so much to operate it, and of course, in the past, it cost so much for the fuel to run the power plant. Plus, you need a profit on your invested capital so you can attract capital from Wall Street. So in the case of some, like an electric utility in California, the rate of return might be something like 12 to 14%. And so you'd say, what is the cost of generation of electricity with solar panels? What's the cost of generation electricity with wind turbines and tidal plants and geothermal plants and so on, plus a reasonable rate of return? And that determines the price. Now, it becomes more sophisticated when you break it out by technology. Of course, you got different prices for different technologies, but you can also make it even more sophisticated, what I call advanced renewable tariffs, advanced feed-in tariffs, by determining the size of solar plants. Do you want 100 megawatt solar plants in a desert? Well, maybe you don't. Maybe you want smaller solar plants on your roof, so they might be a little bit more expensive than a big solar plant in the desert. So you say, okay, for solar plants on your roof, we'll pay a little bit more. What about wind turbines? Well, maybe we can put wind turbines very cheap. We can get cheap electricity by putting them in pristine areas in the Tehachapi Mountains. But where the people live in California, where you're living, Harvey, is down there in the Los Angeles Basin. Are there no wind turbines down there? Well, maybe we need to put the wind turbines down there. Maybe it's not as windy. Maybe the permitting issues are much more costly, so we have to pay a little bit more. We say, okay, so within the L.A. Basin, wind energy, we pay a certain price. But we did all this before, and somehow we forgot how to do that, or we forgot that we even knew how to do that. We forgot that we even did do that. But we did, and we can once again regulate electricity generation like we regulated in the past with a big difference. We can
well,
do it.
Well, we're talking, Paul, we're going to take a short break.
Yeah, okay.
We're talking with Paul Geip, the master of the feed-in tariff and one of the great pioneers of the solartopia and wind industry. And when we come back, what we're going to do, Paul, is I'm going to have you, if you don't mind, explain to us exactly what's going on in Germany and France and the other countries that have opted in to the feed-in tariff situation. And from there, we'll explain in very clear detail how the United States could get onto a totally renewable basis. We're with Paul Geip. We're going to hear my buddy Dana Lyon sing the Solartopia song, and we'll be back in just a couple of minutes.
Pipelines, mega dams, Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan, oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam, road rage, asthma, famine, leukemia, it's time to get a better plan. Solartopia is home sweet home.
All right, Dana, thanks again for the rousing version of the Rocky Top chorus of the Solartopia song with Paul Guype, one of the original, one of the true Solartopians, pioneering the way in wind power way back in the 1970s, and now one of the very few Americans who's really out there advocating, understanding, and explaining the feed-in tariff. So, Paul, in before the break, you basically explained that under the feed-in tariff, the regulatory agencies set a fee for which the utilities must pay to buy renewable energy from whoever puts it into the grid. And my understanding, and correct me if I'm wrong in explaining it that way, but my understanding is that in Germany in particular and other countries, that the feed-in tariff is in place. And, of course, in Germany, it's had a huge impact. So can you tell us what's happening in Germany with the transition to renewable energy?
Well, let's start with the good news first, Harvey. Of course, the Germans have reached 25% of their electricity supply from new renewables. That's wind and solar and so on. And it's all been done with the feed-in tariff, as you told your listeners. That's the good news. The bad news is that the massive installation of wind and solar energy in Germany has threatened the profitability, in fact, the survivability of the five big utilities in the country, electric utilities in the country. And in fact, their earnings of the five big utilities has been disastrous, been way off. They're actually losing money the last couple of years because they haven't made these investments in renewable energy. As a consequence, there's nothing more dangerous than a wounded, cornered animal. And it's evidence in Germany today in the last election, which was just a few months ago, the utility industry was successful. The current ruling party in reaching their coalition agreement with the Social Democrats, that's the equivalent to our Democrats here, actually, not really equivalent to our Democrats here, but anyway, the other party in Germany, so the ruling conservative party and the coalition entered a coalition with the Social Democrats. In a coalition agreement, the utilities were seen on a regular basis coming in and out of the chancellor's office, and they pretty much got what they want, and that is a restriction in the growth of renewable energy in Germany. That is, the Germans are not abandoning the development of renewable energy, but they're going to, in the past, when the Germans met their targets, they've exceeded their targets, they reached their targets much quicker than anybody thought possible. The Germans very rightly turned around and said, well, obviously our targets are too conservative, so we should set more aggressive targets. And they were consistently doing that. But now they're saying, oh, our targets, we're going to meet our targets, but we're way ahead of schedule. So we don't have to go quite as aggressively as we did in the past. And to slow things down, we're going to eliminate the feed-in tariffs. So they still have feed-in tariffs for rooftop solar. I know that's something that's very close to your heart in the Solartopians, rooftop solar. But in terms of the other kinds of renewables that make a big difference in getting to 100% renewable energy supply that we're working towards, they want to eliminate feed-in tariffs because these have become a threat to the existing utilities in Germany. But what's essentially happened in Germany today, Harvey, is they're guaranteeing a market to the existing electric utilities. Before, the market that the utilities had was gradually being eroded by the addition of solar and the addition of wind and the addition of biogas. So in the coming years, they're practically clamping down on biogas, be very little biogas built. This year will probably be a big boom in wind energy. What happens next year, we don't know. And solar has been clamped down to only 2,500 megawatts this year. Still rivals most places in the world. And, of course, a lot of people have been writing dire, dire prognosis for the future of renewable energy in Germany when you say what happened. Germans have been have developed 50,000 megawatts of renewable capacity in 10 years. You say, well, maybe the Germans have a right to step back and take a look at it. When the United States or California achieves that level of penetration, then maybe we can start looking at the Germans and saying, well, maybe they need to do a little bit more. But as it is, the Germans have stepped back, and it's not a good sign. But we have to look at the progress that's been made, and it's remarkable. 25% of their electricity today comes from new renewables, and it's all due to a feed-in tariff.
Well, that's a fascinating story. So basically what you're saying is that the conversion of renewable energy in Germany has been too successful, and that as a result of its enormous success based on the feed-in tariff, what's left of the entrenched utility companies is pushing back and trying to clamp down on solar.
They're trying to restrict the amount of renewable energy that can be built.
How are they restricting it? What restrictions are they using to slow down the growth of renewables?
Well, first of all, they'll only allow... Well, it's easy, Harvey. If you don't offer a price that works, you don't get anything. And if you don't guarantee a connection, you don't get connected. I mean, it's the way we control renewable energy in this country. We have these renewable portfolio standards, which really are not about developing renewable energy. It's about limiting how much renewable energy we can do. So that's basically what they're going to do in Germany. They're saying, well, gee, let's go to an auction system. And who's going to bid in the auction system? Just other utilities like the big utilities now.
So
individual companies, small entrepreneurs won't be able to participate, so they'll regain control. So it's not just about developing renewable energy, Harvey. Utilities can develop renewable energy, too. You can have a Solartopia, and it can all be owned by Pacific Gas and Electric. Now, I don't think you'd like that, but, you know, we can have a Solartopia, and it all be owned by PG&E or Electricité de France. But it can. The beauty of renewable energy, wind and solar and so on, is that we can own it. I know it's a radical idea in the United States that we, the people... Sounds familiar. I think it's someplace in our Constitution we, the people, can actually own our own renewable energy. And so that's what the Germans were doing. If you wanted to find a Jeffersonian Democrat in the world today, they would speak German.
Well, then tell me that the 25% of the capacity in Germany that's now
that's not capacity. Harvey, that's the actual energy, the electricity, not capacity, just to get you straight there.
So in 2014, you're saying that a quarter of the electricity that was produced in Germany was produced by renewables?
Correct. New renewables. So, you know, they did have a little bit of hydro.
And who owns it? How is the ownership of what's now in place in Germany basically distributed?
50%. Of all those solar panels you see when you take a train across Germany or when you fly over into Frankfurt, all those windmills you see, all those solar panels and all those buildings, 50% of that is owned by people like you and me, people like your listeners, like your neighbors.
That's sort of like green. It's like Karl Marx turned green here.
It's like Karl Marx turned to green capitalist.
Uh-huh.
Because they're doing this not only because it's a good thing to do, it's a green thing to do, but they're doing it because it makes money. It makes money to pay for their child's education. It makes money to pay for their retirement. It makes money for them to use however they want to use it. That's the beauty of a feed-in tariff. It does play to our desire to make money. But at the same time, to do good and be profitable.
Amazing. So Germany basically is having heart failure over this.
I mean, it's a conversation like this, it's kind of hard to get the full picture of. Say, now, Germany, no, but the utilities, yes, they're having a heart failure over this. And so there is a groundswell of opposition to the government's policy, because all the cooperative societies, all the societies that encourage cooperative ownership, all the farmer societies, all those conservative farmers we have in the United States, they're conservative in Germany too. All those Bavarian farmers, and you don't get more conservative than Bavarian farmers, they're just furious. Because if they don't have their wind turbine now, the government's saying, well, you don't get one. Or if you don't have the solar panels on your barn now, well, in the case of solar panels, you might be able to put them on your barn. But in case of a wind turbine, they're going to say, well, then you have to go into this process here, and you have to bid against Electricité de France or Énergie de Portugal or PG&E or Florida Power and Light. And what farmer is going to win a bid against Florida Power and Light? They're not.
Wow. Well,
so in Germany, there is an opposition to what's happened, and it could be that in a couple of years they will change their position to back to where it is today. I mean, the argument that the Minister of Energy is using, he says, well, let's try this for a couple of years, and if we don't make progress towards our targets, we'll revisit it once again. Does that sound familiar? Sounds like a lot of American politicians, well, we're going to try this little thing here and call us in a couple of years and tell us how we're doing.
Well, certainly that's been done in the state of Ohio. Ohio was the first state to have a really radical pushback against renewables. They've put in all sorts of regulations. They've really done their very best to stomp out. Ohio, there was a $2 billion wind project, my understanding, that was shelved because the Ohio legislature wants to further study renewable energy. These are the guys who are always yelling and arguing for a free market, and then when it comes and threatens their interests, they kind of have a heart failure. But nonetheless, Paul, isn't it true that electric rates in Germany plummeted as a result of the onslaught of renewable energy?
That's partly true, and so it's important to explain this. This is complicated. Okay, so what you may read in the conservative press and the right-wing echo chamber by those talk show hosts is that the Germans pay the highest cost of electricity in Europe, and it's because of those damn windmills and solar panels. Well, that's not true. First of all, they don't pay the highest cost in Europe. That's the Danes. But the second thing is, it's not because of renewables. Half the cost of electricity in Germany is due to tax. They tax energy. Can you believe that? They tax energy in Europe because they consider it a luxury. It's not an essential thing. It's not like water. It's not like food. And half of the cost of electricity in Germany, which is about 25 to 30 cents a kilowatt hour for a homeowner, is tax. And the other big chunk of price increases over the last 10 years has been from the utilities. It's been from the fossil fuel-fired utilities because of the high cost of fossil fuels. Now, what you are referring to is the funny thing that when we put a lot of renewable energy on the system, the spot market price for electricity plummets. It can go to zero. It can go negative. Now, this just for me goes to illustrate how so-called market in electricity is so fraught with intellectual dishonesty. How can you have a negative price for something that costs something? So anyway, when we flood the market with renewable energy, the spot market price for electricity can go to zero, can go to a negative value. What happens then is the electric utilities start losing their shirt, because they have power plants that are out there burning coal and natural gas, and they can't turn them off that fast. And then when they turn them off, they're not making any money because they have to sell electricity to make money. And so what's happened then is they've lowered the average spot market price in Germany. That's a benefit to all consumers, industrial consumers and residential consumers. But that's a big negative to existing electric utilities.
Amazing. Essentially now, Germany has shown, of course, I want to make it clear that the big push for this did come from the movement against nuclear power. Germany was really hammered with radiation from Chernobyl, and it had 19 nuclear plants. It was a big movement, and there was actually going to be a huge demonstration. Well, they made an agreement to phase out their nuclear plants and then went back on it, and there was a giant demonstration called in Germany to revive the phase-out of nuclear power that had previously been agreed to, and which was not being abided by the center-right government Angela Merkel. And then between the time they called the rally and the rally itself, Fukushima happened. And so
Angela Merkel turned 180 degrees and
right.
stepped up in front of the microphones and said, we are going to phase out nuclear power in Germany.
Bang. And I think good for her.
Well, so, you know, you have to say, unlike here in North America, where 90%, 99% of our politicians are attorneys, they still elect scientists to government in Germany. Angela Merkel has a PhD in nuclear physics. So
yep.
she's actually somebody who understands this stuff. Now, it's true, Harvey, that the previous government had set a policy to close all the nuclear power plants by 2022. And they and Merkel's party had campaigned on a platform to remove that restriction, remove the phase-out in under pressure from their utility contributors. But once Fukushima happened, Merkel, who understands this stuff, stood up and said, okay, forget everything I've said, forget our campaign, forget the law we just passed, extending the life of the reactors, we're going to phase the damn things out. And they did it. I mean,
yeah.
they're on
well,
track to phase them out. They've got what? They've got, what, seven, nine reactors off now?
They shut eight or nine. There's 10 or 11 left, and they will be down by 2022. So the question now, Paul Guype, is what can we do in California, which is the flagship of the United States? It has not renounced renewables as Florida, Ohio, and other companies, which are wholly owned subsidiaries of the utility companies. There still seems to be a battle going on here. There still seems to be a spread of renewables. But does California have a feed-in tariff law?
Yeah, technically we do. We've had one for over 5 years. Did you know about it? Of course you didn't know about it because it hadn't done anything. It wasn't designed to do anything. It was just a sop to a few municipal utilities who wanted to burn some biogas. The fact that we were flaring biogas at sewage treatment plants in the 2000s should be shocking enough. We generated electricity with biogas in the 20s at our sewage treatment plant. So anyway, yes, we've had a feed-in tariff here. We've had it for quite a while, but we made it so convoluted it wouldn't work. And that's, you know, what's wrong with us Americans? We can't do anything simply when our objective is to make something work. Well, then the implication is, well, maybe we really don't want it to work. So it didn't. I mean, the last time I checked, it had 50 megawatts. That was it. Okay, maybe they got up to 75.
Oh. Do you think that California has the capacity with current technology and its available resources to generate all of its power with renewable energy?
Oh, yes. Yes, but I think, Harvey, so the answer to that general question is yes, of course. Yeah, we can do that. But the intellectual movement is well beyond that now. So we here in the United States, maybe your listeners, maybe most other people working in the energy industry think that this is still a relevant question. Can we in California generate 100% of our electricity with renewable energy? Okay, maybe we really only want to do 99% or 98%, but then, you know, that's close enough to 100 for me. But the intellectual effort now is for 200%. 250%, 300% renewable energy in places like California. So your question is, well, what are you going to do with all that electricity? Well, remember, electricity is just a small portion of the energy we use. What the biggest what do we consume the most of in California? It's not electricity. It's oil. It's gasoline. We need to have an electric transportation system. That includes, of course, high-speed trains. Trains running up and down the valley using electricity. Includes electric cars. We could probably... Well, now, go ahead.
Now, in my house here in the valley, in Los Angeles, as soon as this show is over, I'm going to be talking to somebody from Solar City. And we're going to talk about putting photovoltaic cells on the roof of this house. And the rooftop, unfortunately, slants east-west. But nonetheless, for those who don't know, you really want your roof to slant south if you're going to put the solar on it in the northern hemisphere. But nonetheless, is there a program that I can go to that will give me a good deal on putting solar panels on my house? I got to say, my daughter, who lives around the corner, put solar panels on her house, put no money down, and they will own the panels in 20 years. It's a lease arrangement. And they save $1,600 on their electric bill in the first 6 months.
Okay, who's your utility? Who's the utility?
L.A., the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power.
They have a feed-in tariff program. If Solar City tries to sell you a lease, show them the door. You know, Solar City is absolutely opposed to a feed-in tariff because it's a threat to their business model. The lease is not a good deal.
And so what? Do we want to buy our solar panels and put them on the roof and own them?
Why don't you want to own them, Harvey? Why should Elon Musk own them? He's rich enough.
Well, where does Elon Musk come into this?
He owns Solar City.
Oh, I see. All right. So I should not buy PV from Solar City and then power my Tesla from which I'd love to get.
Well, I leave you to your negotiations with Elon Musk. I don't want to get between you and Elon. Because he's got big rockets, too, you know.
Yeah, I know. I've asked him on the show, but he wanted to put a rocket launcher in the backyard, and we don't really have room. So, at any rate, so you're saying, what is standing in the way? Could we, for example, have an initiative, a ballot initiative in California that would promote renewables and get us to shut the Diablo Canyon nuclear plant?
Well, it's going to take something like that because Brown is not going to move unless he's kicked in the butt. Brown made a commitment when he campaigned for office of 12,000 megawatts of distributed generation. He seems to have forgotten that commitment and does Picker. Picker is his hand-picked subordinate and now his hand-picked chairman of the California Energy Commission. Both seem to have forgotten Brown's original commitment of 12,000 megawatts of distributed generation in the state of California to be developed with a feed-in tariff. Seems to have conveniently forgotten that. The only way to get Mr. Brown to remember that is a petition. Now, petition.
Well,
may...
if you would draft me up an initiative that we could put on the ballot in California to force this to happen, I will do my very best to get it on the ballot. One thing great about California, it does still have the initiative process.
All right. Well, you have Elon Musk call in, and we'll get him to put the money up. Okay.
We got other ways to do it, so I'm going to talk to you further. Paul Guype, I hear Pete Seeger in the background. This hour has just flown by. There's so many other things to talk to you about. We're going to have you back on when Diane Moss can also come on. But thank you so much. Paul, what's your website again?
Wind-work.org. Wind-work.org. Thanks a lot, Harvey.
Paul, thank you. We'll be back, and thank you, everyone. Thank you, crew in New York, for another wonderful Solartopia Hour. Just flew by. I have no idea where the time went, but we will see you again next week in Solartopia.
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found, but don't you know we're gonna
stay tuned to PRN.FM for more empowering ideas from progressive voices. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.